All right. Good evening, this is Barbara Glickstein, and you're tuned into Health Styles, brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College. You can find out more about the center at our website at centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. This past Sunday was International World's AIDS Day, and this is our first segment following that day, and an important content for us to continue to report on. My colleague and I, Diana Mason, who co-produces and co-hosts this show, have been reporting and updating on HIV and AIDS as regularly as we can, perhaps like most media, not frequently enough. So I'm pleased to invite and welcome Jeremiah Johnson. He is at the Treatment Action Group. He is their inaugural HIV Prevention Research and Policy Coordinator. He'll tell you more about that role in just a moment. The Treatment Action Group is an independent AIDS research and policy think tank fighting for better treatment, a vaccine, and a cure for AIDS. Welcome to Health Styles, Jeremiah.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have brought a great amount of background in terms of you both now your education and also experience in working and finding out a lot about the world of both prevention and treatment of HIV and AIDS, but you also have a personal story that informs your practice. Will you share that with us?
Absolutely, and thank you for asking me about that. This career that I've embarked on definitely comes from a very personal space. Growing up as a gay man in Colorado and in some rather socially conservative parts of Colorado, I found it difficult growing up to be honest and open about who I was. And it became very difficult for me to talk about my fears around HIV and my fears about how I could get HIV. Ultimately, I ended up becoming HIV infected myself. And it's a bit of an interesting story because I was in the Peace Corps at the time that I was infected. I was in Ukraine.
Were you in Kyiv?
I was outside of Odessa on the Moldovan border, so.
I know the region well, I'll tell you later. I've traveled to that part of the world frequently.
Oh, great, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful place, and I was lucky enough to spend 17 months there teaching English to Ukrainian teenagers, which was probably even more challenging than my career now in some ways.
We love those teenagers, don't
we? We do. They're problematic sometimes, but they were just wonderful to work with. And I also had the privilege to actually do some work while I was there on trying to get some HIV prevention messaging going. Because, as I said, being a gay man growing up, I was always aware of HIV and very concerned about it. And so it was a passion even at that time to start to educate about it. But knowledge doesn't translate into behavior, and it certainly didn't translate into behavior for me. The reality is that protecting yourself from HIV is very difficult and requires a lot of personal discussions around topics that people don't feel comfortable talking about all the time. And for me, and unfortunately, I never got to have those conversations. And I found myself 17 months into Peace Corps getting an HIV positive test result back as part of a mid-service medical exam.
So you were, was it a part of a mandatory screening being in the Peace Corps, or you chose at that time to have that test?
I chose at that time. It was just sort of a regular part I knew of, you know, being a young gay man, was when you get offered a test, you say yes. So I was trying to be, you know, to take care of my own health, basically. And I still think it was the right decision to take that test. What I didn't know was that the Peace Corps would consider that a reason to dismiss me from service. I absolutely wanted to continue my service. And it was actually the first thing that I asked my doctor immediately afterward. He had this very serious look on his face, and he was very concerned about my emotional well-being. And my first thing was, can I finish my service? Mm-hmm. I had 10 months to go. Unfortunately, when we contacted the administration for Peace Corps, they decided that I wouldn't be able to continue my service because they told me at that time that it would be bad for my health to continue my service, and that I wouldn't be able to continue my work adequately because of my HIV status.
And were you symptomatic at the time?
I wasn't symptomatic at all. All that was required was regular blood work and possibly medication. And I actually had another volunteer in my program who was diabetic, which is in many ways much more difficult to manage. So their justifications for dismissing me were not founded on facts, and I can't help but feel were based on some stigmatizing sort of perceptions of what HIV is and what it means to be a person living with HIV.
And this was what year again?
This was 2008.
And not 1987.
Yeah, no, yeah. Not. I mean, this is a time when, you know, I think on some level, many people working in HIV and certainly people outside of HIV sort of feel like this is something that we're handling as a society, that we're handling stigma and discrimination around HIV. But here I was seeing a government, you know, entity actually discriminating against me based upon my status.
I'm moved by your story and how you hit up against a policy that wasn't based on fact. What happened after that?
Well, after that, I headed back to Colorado, and I basically had to, you know, rebuild my entire life. I had anticipated having an extra 10 months to sort of prepare to transition. So I had to find a job. I had to tell my dad why I had come home early. I had to tell my friends, and I had to find a place to live, all of those things. And quite frankly, I don't know what might have happened with this discrimination that I experienced, except for that fortunately before I left Washington, D.C., and when I was told I couldn't continue my service, I was in Washington, D.C., which is a great place to be if you're ever getting discriminated against.
Why is that?
Because you could walk two blocks down the street to some national HIV/AIDS organization who's more than happy to take care of your case. So before I left Washington, D.C., I got in contact with some people who eventually connected me with the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU. And months later, while I was in Colorado just trying to get my life back together, the ACLU contacted me. They asked about the details of my case and asked if I had wanted to continue my service, and I said that I had. And they offered to represent me in threatening a lawsuit against Peace Corps to ensure that they changed their policy. Within 3 months, we issued a press release in which I was named, in which my face actually ended up on the cover of a magazine through all of this. It was a real whirlwind. Especially being newly HIV positive. And
were you able to, was the case, did it ever move into be a case, or were you in fact able to have an action just by putting this out there in the media? Did the Peace Corps respond?
So the response at first through the Peace Corps, unfortunately, was to try everything they could to not be culpable.
Just,
you know,
shut
in this situation.
This down, right?
Exactly.
Just shut this baby down.
Yeah, they didn't want this bad press, and they didn't want the ACLU on their back. So their first defense was to say that I had not requested to continue my service.
Ooh.
Fortunately, I had spoken to a lawyer while I was in Washington, D.C., and we had put a letter in my file saying that I expressly did not agree with them kicking me out for this. So that didn't hold water. Then they said that it had never happened to a previous volunteer. And so they just didn't know how to handle it, basically. At that time, another volunteer came forward.
Why am I surprised, Jeremiah?
Fortunate that this volunteer, Rebecca Colburn, that she had the bravery to come out at this point with my story in the media and say that the same thing had happened to her in Burkina Faso back in 2000. So that didn't hold water. And then they tried to just defend the policy on its own merit, basically saying that it was for my own good and that I wouldn't be able to complete my duties as a volunteer. And of course, that didn't hold water because anybody, you know, working in HIV and any medical professional who knows anything about HIV can come forward and say that's not true. So fortunately, after a lot of uproar and a lot of really putting my personal story out there, a story I wasn't totally ready to put out there in many ways, we ended up getting the policy changed within 3 months.
Well, I'm happy to hear that ending, and I'm sure, as you just said, that all of this new information, returning back from Ukraine and then finding yourself on the cover of magazines and personally putting yourself out there, catapulted your work as an advocate and a strong supporter of the both human rights and civil rights of those living with HIV positive status. Mm-hmm. Which brings us sort of to TAG and the Treatment Action Group and this new position that you have just taken on as their prevention research and policy coordinator. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I saw in your, in addition to many other beautiful things on the TAG website about the work that they do, in your bio around where you hope to go with things, is to really look at what's not working. You know, what has been, clearly there's been some effectiveness in terms of certain actions, and fortunately because of activism like by people like you in the community and policy folks, as well as healthcare people and government officials for some part, have really made an impact. But we haven't made the full impact that we can. And right. How do we know that? How do we know that, Jeremiah Johnson, my guest on Health Styles, who is the Treatment Action Group's new HIV prevention research and policy coordinator? What's the status of things today, and how do we know that we haven't reached any milestones that we can still be reaching?
Right. Well, you know, the big factor is that we've just been stuck at around 50,000 new infections per year for a very long time now. And
that's U.S.-based.
That's U.S.-based, yes. And what's unfortunate about that is that based upon some interventions that we have, especially some new biomedical interventions, there's no reason that we should still be stagnating at 50,000 a year. The other thing that's really disheartening about it is that within that 50,000, you know, if that's a big pie, you know, the different proportions of the pie change about who falls into that. And so where we've had a lot of success with, you know, mothers and babies, and where we've had success with, you know, getting more needle exchange programs out there to help curb the epidemic amongst people who inject drugs, we're still seeing that 50,000 number, which means that those new infections are just transferring into other populations, and it's actually expanding in other populations. So right now what we're seeing is that men who have sex with men, you know, are still the number one risk category here. And not only that, but their number of new infections are increasing right now. And amongst young men who have sex with men between 2008 and 2010, there was a 22% increase in the number of new infections. And that disproportionately affects communities of color.
And so why are we not talking about this more? What's your sense of, is it, I know that the campaigns that are targeted to populations seem to still be around, maybe not as, they're not on the subways as much anymore, I could say. You know, I'm a New Yorker and I look at these things. So what are the campaigns that exist, and are they responsible for them not working as a public health person?
You know, my opinion is that the conversation is being had, but not necessarily being acted on. I think that we've seen some great milestones over the past few years. We do have a national HIV/AIDS strategy, thanks to the Obama administration. You know, for the first time after, you know, over 30 years of this epidemic, we actually have a plan in place with some targets that we want to reach. And, you know, I think that there are a lot of really intelligent people that are working in HIV prevention at the government level, at the grassroots level, all around, that are talking about this and trying to find out what's going on in these communities, what can we do? However, translating those conversations into action isn't happening effectively enough. And we don't necessarily understand why. And it's sort of my position and, you know, the position of TAG that we need to come up with a scientific way to look at the implementation science behind this. How are we taking these interventions that we know work in like a clinical trial? How do we take that with other interventions that we've been using? And how do we turn those into comprehensive prevention strategies for these communities that are most at risk and make sure that it's getting out there and actually reaching the people that need it?
Jeremiah Johnson, my guest from the Treatment Action Group, talking about prevention research and policy. Earlier you mentioned that as a young gay man growing up in Colorado, that there were reasons you weren't asking questions. There were reasons you weren't comfortable to have conversations. And you also said something that we all live with, which is information doesn't change behavior.
Right.
I know that personally. I have a lot of information and I'm still not exercising as much as I know I should.
Right.
So that disconnect is lived by each one of us. And so campaigns of information, and many of the campaigns, as you have noted in your talks that I listened to in your TED New York talk, are very fear-based.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about those fear-based campaigns, and is there research and data to support their effectiveness, or do we just continue to bash people on the head with this kind of fear-based campaign? It's kind of like just say no to drugs and your brain looks like a fried egg when you do them.
Right.
We know they didn't work.
We know that they didn't work. And yet we do still continue to try these sorts of campaigns. And, you know, here in New York, especially, we try them for teen pregnancy, we try them for smoking, we try them for obesity. And of course we had the It's Never Just HIV campaign a few years ago, which used, you know, these very fear-based, shameful tactics to basically try and scare, you know, young gay men into having safer sex. The problem with all of this is that the evidence behind this is, in my opinion, I've never seen a study that really convinces me that these sorts of campaigns translate into any lasting behavior change. And not just in HIV, we're talking, you know, about any sort of health behavior. Even smoking, where we try to, you know, the CDC just recently released a report on their national smoking campaign, which was very fear-based, trying to claim that, you know, a lot of people quit smoking because of this. But the problem is that they make a lot of assumptions in these studies. In that particular study, I think they only followed people for 3 months afterward, and they declare victory that these campaigns actually work. But the problem is that a lot of times these studies can show that in the short term, you can get a behavior change from people in some cases, but long term, it doesn't necessarily stick. And the other really large problem with this is that we're not necessarily measuring the negative side effects of these sorts of campaigns. Because when you're trying to make an entire population afraid, you know, when you're trying to make people feel worse about their sexuality, about their eating habits, about, you know, whatever they use to try and cope and make it through their life, however they derive pleasure out of life, you're attacking something very central to them. And we don't know how that affects people's mental health. And we don't know how it shuts down conversations. And in my opinion, what these campaigns really need to do is open conversations. I want to see positive campaigns that link people to medical professionals, to, you know, experts on this topic, where they can have an open conversation, to where fear and shame-based campaigns, to me, shut that down.
You identified that in the young gay men of color, this 22% increase in the rate of new infections is quite startling, and we not across the board. I don't know what the socioeconomic status is of that 22%, but we certainly know that in communities of color, there are significant social determinants and disparities, mm-hmm. or health disparities. That term social determinants and health disparities are sometimes used interchangeably, that already impacts a community that, one, has had a tremendous sense of lack of trust of healthcare, a tremendous living conditions that are part of health and well-being, and in spite of that, tremendous success out of those families and communities. So I don't mean to paint in all gloom. However, in terms of healthcare and in terms of what those social determinants impact is, how is that being addressed as part of a campaign? And how do you see yourself maybe being involved in addressing it in that way, with that frame?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. We can't look at, you know, any health disparities in society, not just HIV. But it's never just HIV. You know, it's, you know, all sorts of different health conditions impact different communities. You know, if you have darker skin in our society, you're just more at risk for getting certain types of health conditions at some point. So we have to be addressing that. We have to be looking at, what is it about racism? What is it about homophobia? What is it about transphobia? What is it about HIV-related stigma in general? What is it about all of these different forms of hate in our society that lead to people being more at risk for HIV and other health conditions? And what are the types of interventions that we need to do to try and correct that? I think right now there's a lot of momentum in HIV around biomedical interventions. We have pre-exposure prophylaxis now. We have post-exposure prophylaxis, which, pre-exposure prophylaxis is one pill that you take every day that can, with perfect adherence, lower your risk of getting HIV by up to 99%.
Are there side effects or what is the expense of it? Is it an affordable medication for most people?
That's a really great question. In New York, thanks to the Affordable Care Act, it's going to be a lot more accessible. I believe it's going to be covered by Medicaid, and most insurance companies are willing to cover it, I believe. But people who are interested in that should certainly talk to whoever their insurance provider is to see if they can get it covered.
I just want to mention that in my research before today's program, I did find that there's an online resource called Obamacare and You, mm-hmm. and it's dedicated to the specific needs of people living with HIV and AIDS who are looking for healthcare coverage. So
Right. Perhaps
we can just mention that and this idea of what's available. So there's the pre and then there's the post. So we
right.
have the medical intervention, which has its benefits and also probably some concerns about people being on a lifelong medication.
Right.
Prophylactically.
Mm-hmm. The one thing I will say about the concerns around that is, you know, we have to be careful not to have sort of a double standard for HIV versus other medications. I've never been on birth control, but as I understand, that has a lot of side effects for people.
It certainly does. I have, and it does.
So, because that's something that's sort of expected in society. You know, I think that's, there are somehow less hurdles sometimes to get to that. To where for someone who wants to be on a relatively well-tolerated regimen to prevent HIV, I think we get really tied up in that, and we have to be careful about why we're doing that.
We only have a minute or two left, and I wondered if I can give you a moment to envision a picture of what type of public health campaign would you design, Jeremiah Johnson, if you were able to design, if a mm-hmm. load of money was dropped in tag for both a short campaign, but a really positive policy to impact future public health campaigns?
Well, my personal opinion is that you need to have a public health campaign that's very positive and affirming. And that also shows some sort of joint ownership between people who are HIV positive and HIV negative. So often there's this division in these communities of HIV negative people having to be wary of the HIV positive people. And I like to point out that I'm HIV positive and I'm working in keeping people HIV negative. We're in this together. And I think a real campaign can really show that. And another very important piece of any campaign is that we need to be targeting all of the people who work with that community, and especially healthcare providers, so that they know how to answer the questions that are most important to those communities, that they can have open conversations about sexuality and drugs and gender identity and things that, you know, or maybe they're not prepared to talk about. We need to be targeting healthcare providers also to make sure that they're equipped to have these conversations with their patients.
Thank you. Jeremiah Johnson is Treatment Action Group's inaugural HIV Prevention Research and Policy Coordinator. The Treatment Action Group is an independent AIDS research and policy think tank fighting for better treatment, a vaccine, and a cure for AIDS. Thank you so much for joining me on Health Styles this
evening.
Thank
you.
This is Barbara Glickstein. You've been tuned into Health Styles, brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College. Find out more about us at our site at centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. Thank you and be well.